All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fucksters? What the fuckadelics? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you for stopping by. Our guest today is Robin Hitchcock, who is one of those guys that a lot of people know, and the people that know him and love him know all about him and love him and have all his records. He's been around a long time. My experience with him, I remember when someone, I don't even remember who turned me on to the Soft Boys record, Underwater Moonlight. I think it might have been Jay Dobis, Jonathan Richman's friend in Boston, Massachusetts. Maybe. But I'd never heard of the Soft Boys, and I got this record, and the cover, I didn't love the cover, the Soft Boys Underwater Moonlight, and I'm not even sure when it came out, but I'm sure I got it after the fact, and I played that record to fucking death. I was like, what the hell? Who's this deep, angry dude writing these psychedelic lyrics? What is with the sound of this thing? And I love that record. And then I grew to, you know that Robin Hitchcock was the driver of the Soft Boys, and then later, Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians' Globe of Frogs came out, and I was like, this is great, Globe of Frogs, this, the lyrics are awesome, it sounds like the Beatles and Pink Floyd fucked each other, I like it. And then, you know, he did some solo stuff here and there. He's done a lot of stuff, and I was thrilled to talk to him. Robin Hitchcock is a force to be reckoned with. He's a hell of a songwriter, and I was thrilled to have him in here. I'm not sure he knew where he was going or what exactly it was, but and he was a bit tired from the road, but he did hang out, and we did get to know each other, and we have common friends, too. Eugene Merman is a champion of the Hitchcockian. Also, Robin's got a new record out called The Man Upstairs, which is available now. And I think, once you get the hang of Robin, you're going to fucking want it all. They just reissued a Soft Boys record. I think the first Soft Boys record. I don't remember who did it, but I have it on vinyl. And get Underwater Moonlight, though. That's where I entered. Why not enter there? I Want to Destroy You, Insanely Jealous are two songs that really resonated with me at the time I listened to them. Of course, I'm beyond that now. But yeah, so that's coming up in a second, me and Robin chatting. On and off. You know, I've been talking about the patent troll, Personal Audio, who came after podcasters. It was and is, you know, a frightening prospect that they claimed that they had a patent that covered some of the technology involved in podcasting. And oddly, none of us had that technology, but by utilizing or using the technology, they decided that we were infringing on their patent, and they, you know, that we required to license it from them. And they tried to extort money from many of us. Most of us just by threatening letters, mildly threatening letters. But okay. So whether or not you understand the full, you know, scope of what was going on there, it was basically a shakedown racket trying to get podcasters to cough up money of an undisclosed amount based on a conversation that we would have with them if we had that conversation, which I didn't. They would determine the amount, how much money it would take to protect ourselves from them again. You get how it works. Extortion is extortion. A shakedown is a shakedown. But as many of you do know, or maybe not, Adam Carolla was actually sued by Personal Audio. Now this whole situation, it was going on for a while, and it was horribly aggravating and scary. And, you know, we can finally, you know, feel some relief here. And let me just, you know, I'll just try to parse it out for you. The way they're spinning it, Personal Audio, they said that they settled their lawsuit with Adam. Okay. Now, they like using the word settled because it makes it sound like money was paid out. That is not true. In fact, a more accurate word would be dismissed, because the lawsuit against Carolla is dead. Personal Audio also put into writing, folks, that they will not go after podcasters anymore. Now, obviously, they didn't list all podcasters, but they did list, you know, the core group of us that was sort of, you know, sounding off about the issue. Nerdist, the Earwolf podcast, Jay Moore, Joe Rogan. So they put that in writing. Is it legally binding? Nah, I don't think so. So there's no reason we should really take them at their word, because they haven't been honest brokers from the get-go. But for the time being, we know this. Everyone who fought back against the extortion racket brought attention to the issue of patent trolling. and patent abuse, you know, and help put it on the radar. They came after regular guys like me and Adam, Joe, my friend Sam Cedar, and we reacted as regular guys who were being, you know, shook down. Yeah, we have microphones and we're going to talk about it. Now, I need you to know that Adam can't talk about this for about a month and a half because it's part of the deal. Okay? But in so doing, what we did, you know, speaking out, we protected the medium of podcasting and prevented anyone from having to pay these guys anything. Okay? This is a concerted group effort on behalf of those guys and women who chose to speak up about this publicly. Adam Carolla deserves a lot of fucking credit, folks, for putting it all on the line. All right, he went to bat, man. He fought back at great expense to himself, knowing that the alternative would be to pay Personal Audio a settlement, which they would then use against all of us as a precedent, you know, to shake down all of us. And they would have legal precedent to do that. And yes, he raised a lot of funds to help pay his legal bills. But the bottom line is he's still in the hole to the tune of about $200K. You know, even with all the money you gave him in support, you know, he was in, I think he went in, you know, close to like $600,000-$700,000. And he was going to fight it all the way through. But the bottom line is they dismissed it. Why wouldn't he take that deal? But I guess most importantly, this fight isn't over. Thanks to the attention we all brought to this situation, the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has a pending review of this garbage patent that Personal Audio was using, and the review is real and solid and could invalidate this patent forever. That means they'll never be able to sue anyone with it ever again. That's a big deal, and it might not have happened if we didn't get loud about this in the first place. Okay? And for now, Personal Audio is going to go after big dogs like ABC and NBC and CBS. And they say they're going to leave us, you know, all of us podcasters alone. Hopefully, the way we fought back against them will make the big networks realize that they shouldn't just settle with these guys, that they can fight back against these trolls and call their bluff. I still hope that this patent will be invalidated. And I still am excited that people know that this happens because it's a real thing. And, you know, if there's any criticism about, you know, why didn't Adam fight all the way through? Why didn't he, you know, take him to the mat? Why didn't he countersue? I'll tell you why. He didn't have the fucking money. And some people who are, you know, involved with the broader issue of patent trolls and patent reform, you know, think that like, well, this is what always happens. No, it isn't what always happens. We raised awareness of the reality of it. We all fought back. We spoke our minds and we made an impact. And for now, podcasting is protected and the issue of patent trolling is now relevant and out in the world much more than it would have been. And hopefully ABC, NBC, and CBS will just fight this guy. And yeah, definitely the patent system needs some help. Okay, look, Robin Hitchcock, he's here. Let's talk. Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? Well, for me, honestly, it's my stereo system. For years, I've wanted this stereo system. And then at some point, I realized like, hey, you're saving money, buy it. So I got a pretty top of the line tube driven stereo system. It has changed my life. It's not only great for listening to music, it's great for me to sit there with my guitar while I jam or just rock out. Because when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. Just like the all-new Lexus GX. It has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Available dynamic sky panorama glass roof. Available front row massaging seats. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires. And available multi-terrain select system for off-road driving. Drivability. Any of these options will help you take your Lexus GX to the limit, just like I did with my stereo system. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. Talk to him.
Now, are we able to... we can have breaks, presumably.
Sure.
So if I want to get more coffee or go to the bathroom or...
I think we can... Like yeah, that. Sure. Yeah. I can arrange for that. I can arrange to walk you back into my house.
Okay, that's good.
to have that happen. I think I saw you actually... When did you guys... I was a huge Soft Boys fan. Is that okay?
Yeah, I mean... No, that's fine. The Soft Boys... I mean, right, that was a long time ago.
I know that. I know, but I saw you at Irving Plaza when you guys got back together.
Oh, right. That was... what year was 2001, that? Probably. Yeah, yeah.
That was good.
Was it?
Yeah. Were you happy about it? Or does it all just fade away eventually?
No, I think I liked... I think it was good. I think that... I don't know about the reunions, you know, the resurrections. They're kind of... There's a little bit of the... A bit of the undead, a bit of the zombie about it. There's something slightly unnatural about
right.
reconvening a group of men who've been together... in an earlier existence.
But so that was like, but you're talking like 25 years ago, right? Or more.
Oh, well, it had been 20 years since we'd been a band.
Yeah.
And it's now that it's, oh God, I mean, this is 13 years ago. I just felt like, I thought musically it was really good.
Yeah.
But I just thought psychologically it was a bit strange. And it was strange to be... in a group as opposed to just operating under my own name.
Right.
And having to sort of pretend that I was part of a band rather than I was the guy who was the central figure and called all the shots. And,
right.
You know, that it was basically the Soft Boys was a brand that I operated under.
Well, how long were you guys a band, though, actually?
Well, we were only a band for four years, you know, early 77 to early 81. And in that time, there were the drummer, Morris and I were the only constant members. But Morris Windsor and Andy Metcalf, who'd been in the Soft Boys, also comprised the bulk of Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians, which lasted from 84 to 93. And so we kind of had the Soft Boys had a lot of aftershocks.
Yeah.
You know, although we weren't very long together, we had a bunch of reunions.
Yeah.
And we had me and the Egyptians, and then I toured with Kimberly Rue. It was in my band in the late 90s, and then we reconvened as the Soft Boys. And then after the Soft Boys, I had Morris and Kimberly in my British band for a few years.
So you guys all remain friends.
So we, I don't know. I mean, some of us are in touch, you know.
Yeah.
Like I've said, as I say, you know, we will all go to each other's funerals.
You will.
That's how,
out of politeness.
That's how bands operate. Yeah, exactly.
So where did you grow up? How was, because, I mean, you have a unique vision about everything. Where did that come from? Where did you grow up? What was the environment like?
The environment was Britain in the early and mid 1950s. You know, I was born in 1953, so
yeah.
I was born to a father who had been wounded in Normandy in 1944, and his right leg didn't bend, so he had a sort of strange, kind of slightly peg-legged gait. You could hear the money jingling in his trousers as he went up and down the stairs. You could hear his walk, you know.
Was he hit or with shrapnel?
He was hit in the knee with shrapnel. He was lucky in that he didn't have to have his leg amputated.
Yeah.
And I was always very grateful that my father wasn't an amputee.
Yeah.
But,
that would have made you more morbid, probably.
I don't think that would have been possible, but I would have, and I'm sure I'd have dealt with it. But, it did mean my father was what used to be called a cripple. And I think my dad used to run, you know, he'd been a quite athletic boy, but at, you know, 22, he was hit for life, and he was in hospital in Newcastle for 9 months after he was taken out of Normandy. And his mother went to visit him and said, "Oh, I don't know. No one's going to want to dance with you, Raymond. I don't know who's going to want to marry you." So I think he was very grateful when my mother took an interest. So
it's so amazing that generation, because like growing up in the States, or even like, but I wouldn't have. But the idea that like that London was leveled, you know, at some like in recent history is kind of profound.
A lot of it was. I think that was part of the shock of 9/11, because there's been so little warfare on American soil. I mean, you could argue, you know, obviously apart from the Civil War, you could argue that America is in a constant state of warfare on
one everywhere level. Else.
But you know, it same as in Australia. You know, I've just been in Australia. There's lots of Art Deco buildings in Sydney. Britain had just got to Art Deco in the 30s, and that whole thing was stymied by the war. All the buildings stopped, and a lot of buildings were demolished. So there's this whole sort of might have been chapter that just didn't take place, and Australia sort of shows where it might have gone. London was, you know, a lot of, it wasn't totaled like Berlin was,
right,
but there were a lot of bomb sites, there were a lot of gun emplacements around, you know, the cricket, we lived English style actually opposite a village green with a cricket, you know, where they played cricket and stuff, and in the corner was an old gun emplacement.
Oh, really?
That as kids we'd sort of run into, and you know, there'd be
The slots?
There were the slots, you know, and you could pretend to get people in the sights, and meanwhile there was always some horrible kind of fetid thing in the corner, you know, some bundle of rags or newspapers or fecal matter that, you know,
someone was living there.
And then they've been living there. I think they've just gone in there and used it as either a toilet or as a place to copulate.
Yeah.
Both, you know, but some place to have bodily functions out of the prying eye of their neighbours.
And the children.
But of course the children, anyway, you know, the children, and that, which is one of which I was, you know, were scampering around the old brickworks and the gun emplacements. So, yeah, there was a lot of the ghost of World War II was around, you know, the people who were, well, like my dad. I mean, he was in his 30s. Or
whole generation.
There was a whole generation. And people were recovering from World War II.
What did your dad end up doing?
He trained as an engineer, sort of like a scientific engineer. He worked for Mercury Communications, partly to do with the post office. It was sort of like a satellite communications.
And what did he end up doing for a living?
Well, he did that for a while, and then he did cartoons and paintings, and then he wrote a movie. He wrote a book which got made into a movie, which made him a lot of money, which was it's about a guy who has a penis transplant.
Seriously?
It's called Percy, yeah.
When was that
Ray Davis did the music for it.
Oh, really?
It came out in 1970. It's a sort of British... like me, it's a minor British cult.
You know? Right.
It's kind of... It's one of those... It's one of those things that's sort of seen as what used to be saucy or smutty. It wasn't smutty, but because it was about sex, there was an attitude to sex... Certainly in Britain in the sort of 30s, 40s and 50s. You ever heard of George Formby? Do you know Andy Preboy?
Yeah.
Well, Andy Preboy knows a lot of that stuff.
So right.
British, arcane British comedy from that era. And it was that, a whole world of, do you know about the Carry On movies?
No.
It was a whole world of innuendo, British classic seaside postcards, you know, little drawing of a tiny figure playing the piano and a man standing by wishing well with a red face going, "You ruddy idiots, I didn't ask for a 12-inch pianist."
Yeah.
And it's all that whole world of, you know, of kind of innuendo, which which has gone now because everything became much more open about sex in the 60s and 70s.
Right around the time Piercy would have come out.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can't, all that stuff is now very of its time, but you can't make, you couldn't make a movie like those movies anymore because people don't care, you know.
Everyone's been so thoroughly fucked in the head, nothing matters.
Literally. That was the idea, yes.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, although Percy wasn't exactly, it was produced by one of the companies that did that sort of stuff.
Like the Peter Sellers movies?
Yeah, I think Britt Eklund was in was in Percy, actually.
Who played the lead?
A guy called Howell Bennett. Denham Elliott's in it. I don't know. It's you know, it's real. It's especially because Ray Davies did the music. It is,
and you
really
were already
part of it.
A musician at that time. I mean, if it came out in 1970, you were on your way.
No, I was 17. I was playing the guitar, but I didn't meet Ray Davies till about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, really?
But
are you guys friends now?
No, I've just met him a couple of times.
Did you bring up the fact that your dad did it? Was it a connection?
He knew about it. Yeah, he was a bit sniffy about the movie. And, I mean, the movie, it's not great art. My mother was sniffy about it. I think she was hoping that my dad was going to be, you know, produce some
highbrow.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some piece of, you know, William Faulkner or, or something like that, you know. But no, we got the old penis transplant. As for his mother, the lady who visited him in hospital and said, no one's ever going to want to dance with you, I think she had a copy, but she never opened it.
Right.
But you know, it was there. So there was my dad, because he painted and drew and wrote books, and he then went on and wrote plays and had stuff on television and things like that. You know, the short answer to your question is I come from an arts background.
And your mom, did she do it as well or no?
No, my mum she was the daughter of some industrialists, some wealthy South Wales.
Uh-huh.
Welsh border industrialists.
Oh, really?
But she went to university. She was one of the first generation of women to graduate.
Uh huh.
So they have a parade sometimes now of these old graduands who are all, you know, just about to pop off, but then in their late 80s. But women were allowed. You know, they were, I don't know, but women weren't allowed. Eventually they got to university in about the 20s, but they weren't even acknowledged as eligible to graduate until the 40s, which was my
mother's
generation.
So they could do it as a hobby?
They could do it as a hobby, waiting to have children,
yeah,
basically.
Right.
And when my parents met there in the late 40s, my wounded dad and my sort of, you know, wealthy country mother, and
it was
a marriage made in Cambridge.
Yeah.
They
went to Cambridge.
They met at Cambridge University.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in Cambridge in the late 70s and very early 80s. That's where the Soft Boys incubated. So I kind of went back up there to look for musicians in my whatever it was.
When did you start playing? How old were you?
Well, I started playing the guitar when I was 14, but I didn't learn to tune it for the first 6 months. So
that's,
I used to just play along to my... You're too kind. I played along to my, Bob Dylan and Donovan records.
The first
thing I learned was the attitude.
Yeah.
You know, the way the fingers hit the strings and the way you felt and the way you moved your head.
The show.
I didn't do it in front of a mirror, but I did it. I was just so pleased to have my fingers around the guitar. And then I think I realized when the record stopped that somewhere I realized that I had to tune it. And then I got lessons from a guitar teacher three of his fingers had been damaged in an industrial accident. So it was an odd thing to have because they were classical, but he could only get two fingers onto the right hand at the plucking.
Yeah, yeah. So you learned to pluck first?
Well, I learned to pluck, but all I really wanted to do was be Bob Dylan, like most of my generation. You know,
was who you gravitated towards? It wasn't towards, the Beatles were too poppy at that time, or? What were the choices?
The Beatles. Well, the Beatles, You know, if you're there, as a, you grow, whatever you grow up with as a kid is what you take for granted. So
right.
I was living in the, you know, 1963, 64, basically kind of in this village green place. And there was up the road, it was a town, what's called a dormitory town. It's about 25 miles out of Greater London,
yeah,
or whatever, and people could get trains from there into London in 40 minutes, you know, like
right.
a weapon of mass destruction from Iraq to the centre of London, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
My father of limited destruction could get in to London and back at time to, you know, paint mm-hmm. or draw when he got home in the evening. And so... but when the Beatles became successful, they moved south, and three of them all bought houses in this sort of rather naff Beverly Hills area. Are sort of basically people with money but no taste.
Right.
Paul McCartney wisely got a place in you know, Cavendish, whatever it is, in near somewhere nice in St. John's Wood, which
yeah.
which would obviously last him for life. But the other three, with their blonde wives, just went, "Oh, right, I'll have one of them." You know, there you are. Give us a million, mate. Done. So George, and Ringo all got places in this place called St. George's Hill, which
yeah.
was the posh bit of Weybridge.
Right.
And so, you know, by the time I was 11, I knew I was just a mile down the road from the Fabs.
Yeah.
But at that age, you just take it for granted. I never saw them or anything.
Right.
But, you know, but meanwhile, the soundtrack to my adolescence from Please Please Me at 10 to
right.
Abbey Road when I was 16 was the Beatles.
Always.
Exactly. You know,
right.
So, but I never thought I could do anything like that because I didn't have any musical ability, and because pop music was I think, you know, my background was quite snobbish. It was sort of highbrow, you know. We weren't we were sort of kind of middle class people who wouldn't have gone into pop music.
Right.
You know.
Was your mother, did they like classical music or?
My dad liked a good tune. My dad was much more mass market than
yeah.
my mother. And my mother's tastes, I think, were pretty highbrow.
Yeah.
So something like the Beatles, it just didn't occur to me to, you know, that being a pop singer wasn't on the radar. I wanted to be Doctor Who.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be something esoteric.
Right. You knew that early on. That
I knew I wanted to be some kind of character that, and you know, Doctor Who was mass market. That was on TV as well.
But it's very specific.
But it was specific. You know,
yeah.
I want, and then I discovered Dylan, and Bob Dylan was very, he was compelling, but he was also enigmatic.
Right.
And, you know, the Beatles were much more kind of foursquare and obvious.
Right.
I loved the Beatles, but things like Doctor Who and Bob Dylan made a lot more sense to me as a 12, 13-year-old. And if you look at what I've done, I mean, I'm obviously, you know, firmly on the fringe of things.
Sure. And also, that seems to be ideologically and aesthetically makes sense, that Doctor Who and Bob Dylan, certainly now, you know, after, you know, as a solo artist, that seems to make a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah. No, that was that. And then throw in a bit of P.G. Woodhouse, if you know about him. But, you know, the Bertie Wooster, the sort of, you know, stammering upper class twit.
Yeah.
So I basically cobbled myself together from a mixture of Bertie Wooster, Doctor Who and Bob Dylan. And they were all, you know, they were all on the TV or in the radio. They weren't hard to find, but they were a little bit more specific than the Beatles.
But as a songwriter, it seems that, you know, it makes sense to me, though you choose more abstract things, but, you know, in terms of Dylan's ability to turn a phrase and create an image, I mean, that must have pounded that into your head, that, you know, it's just his songwriting capability.
Oh, totally. You know,
yeah.
And also he has a great ability to flip from being arcane and abstract and abstruse to being really specific and putting things in very, very simple terms, you know. And,
and
his music, that if you listen to the way the songs are put together, they're they're pretty simple. You know, when I learned to tune my guitar and I forsook my old teacher with the three broken fingers, I just got hold of a Bob Dylan songbook. And within 10 minutes, I could play Mr. Tambourine Man and Blowing in the Wind and Visions of Johanna because they were all on three chords.
Visions of Johanna. God damn that song.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. The Ghost of Electricity howls in the bone of his upper
face. Yeah.
That's it, right? That's a gateway.
Well, what is totally. That? That's, I mean, that I was 13 when I heard that.
And oh, my God.
That pretty much tipped me over. I just thought, okay, this is where I want to go.
Right. In Divisions of Joanna.
Yeah. Yeah. I think nearly 50 years later, why? I think Visions of Johanna manages to go in two opposite emotional directions at once or more. It's very sad. It's also really funny, and it's quite cruel, and it's quite philosophical, and it's all these moods and feelings are kind of just compressed there into 6 minutes, you know, condensed.
Right. That song to me to this day, you know, because, you know, you look at a catalog like that, and the fact that you and I share that song is interesting because he's got a huge catalog. But for some reason, that song, even to me today, if I listen to it, it's just as powerful as any time first time I listened to it. Like, you sit there and it's almost like your heart and your mind is searching for meaning in lines that necessarily aren't going to provide that or explain themselves, but they'll take you someplace. Every one of them. Like, It's All Right, Mom, I'm only dying. Like, yeah. I'm like, it seems like all the answers are in this song. I don't know what they are. I'm not even sure what the questions are, but they're all there.
Well, that was part of the attraction with Dylan, and also probably a burden that he didn't really want to have to shoulder after a while. He seemed to be the man with the answers. And
no one can quite understand him.
Well, he'd say, you know, no, I'm, he later said something like, well, you know, I'm the first to put the question to you and the last to answer it. But maybe because of the nature of the questions he asked, it seemed like he might have the answer. Okay, well, what is it, Bob? You know, I mean, the thing is, he had wisdom. All the others, you know, and prior to that, entertainers in popular music had been sexy and they'd been fun. And, you know, Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley and the Beatles, they could all do comedy. They could act.
Yeah.
And they could have, they were great singers. But you didn't go to them for enlightenment. Yeah. You know, you went to them because they were sexy and they made you cry, or they were emotional conductors. But they didn't, there wasn't wisdom. It wasn't like, Dylan was like going to a rabbi or listening to a poet. It was suddenly like, it was another level.
Yeah.
It was a different look in the eyes. There was, or at least, you know, there were to us at that age. And so, in a way, that's been his curse. He's had to live with seeming to be the guy who knew something. And people have tried to, I think, almost cut him open for years. You know,
there's that great
documentary. What is it? What's in there, Bob? What is it?
That great documentary, the Don't Look Back documentary. It's amazing with him and Donovan, in that discomfort and the weird people ask him questions that he did. He just completely destroys that one reporter. He's like, you want to be my friend? Why do you want to be my friend? Do you remember that scene in that movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's just like, it's so cutting and so brutal. But I wonder how conscious he is at this point of being Bob Dylan and just doing the job of Bob Dylan.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's up to him to define what the job of Bob Dylan is.
Yeah.
I think he seems to be someone who doesn't like being defined.
Are you the same way?
Probably. I mean, but to say that would be to define myself, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, there's that bit in Magnum Force where they keep, you know, the second Dirty Harry movie, and they have this line that goes through all through the movie. You know, you're a good man, Briggs, and a good man knows his limitations. And when Briggs finally explodes in the car, that, you know, Clint's put the bomb in the trunk, Clint turns to the camera and says, "A man's got to know his limitations, Briggs." But I don't know whether that's true. You know, I suppose there's a difference between limitations and definitions. But if you're too aware of what you're capable of, or how you want to be seen. I mean, it's probably better to market yourself that way. Things are easier to sell if you know what they do, and I've never really defined what it is I do.
Well, I think that people that know that are probably, in my mind, as an artist, they're a little too conscious of selling.
Well, you know, you can see why people would want to sell, especially over here, because there's no safety net.
Right.
And, you know, establish your brand and sell it.
Yeah.
And Dylan did establish a brand, but he was, you know, he was so intense.
He always worked against it, too.
He just likes to...
Yeah.
He likes to move. I was just listening to some old acetates that a friend of mine got hold of Dylan from sort of 1969, 70 or whatever, and it just seems like he'll do something once, and as soon as he starts to mess around with it, he loses it. And a lot of the original versions of things were better than the ones with overdubs and the stuff he fussed over. And I think Bob Dylan's got an instinct for getting it right immediately. I think he hasn't got a great instinct for editing, and I noticed that live he trims all the verses out of, you know, the songs. But when you've got that gift for expression, maybe you can't have that gift for editing. He's not inhibited, but I just think that the instant snapshot, the first brush of the paint on the canvas, the first exhalation of breath, the first thing that pops into your mind is likely to be the most honest and
the most difficult to recapture.
Yes, and I've noticed that when I've recorded demos or I've done a take or something, people, the engineer or the producer will say, "Oh, okay, can you get it like you did on the first one?" And in the end, we'll just use the first one, or that it's what I call the honesty of the unconscious, that actually the first thing you say is what you really mean, and then you start thinking about it. I don't want to be seen to say that. And sometimes in terms of human interaction, you can't say the first thing you said, even if you meant it, because it's too upsetting to, and especially as you get older, you sort of try and censor, you become more aware.
Restraint of pen and tongue.
And exactly, you know. So, but
don't want to cause any trouble.
Exactly, don't want to cause any trouble. But you know, one of the things about being under 30 is that's the time to cause trouble.
Yeah, fuck
and it. Exactly. So, but I think Dylan still has that instinctive gift. I don't think of him as a craftsman. He's not like, say, Nick Lowe, who Nick is very good at working on songs and honing them down, and you know, he's still able to write great songs in under 3 minutes.
He's also a pop songwriter. I mean, you know, he's very conscious of pop structure. You know, he respects it. And it, like, when I look at Dylan, it seems that Dylan was literally working out this wisdom or whatever it is. I think that a lot of Dylan happened on the page, that when he had the pen, it almost becomes like an equation. Those words become an equation, like, you know, the geometry of innocence, flesh on the bone. Where the fuck does that come from? You know, you're not really thinking that, well, this is going to be a great refrain, or this is going to be it seemed like the urgency was in the words.
Yes, the urgency. I'm sure it just struck him as right.
But when you write too, like, I mean, though you, I guess people think you're a psychedelic or a surrealist thinker, but it seems that some of the stuff that you work out, and I'm only going to go back to the Soft Boys for my own, and then we can go, because I mean, Globe of Frogs was another manifestation of you that, like, I listened to compulsively for about a month.
All right, yeah.
And because the production was so, like, amazing, it was mind-blowing, and the harmonies, it was just, and the lyrics, but it seemed like talking where we're talking now, that if I listen to Underwater Moonlight, or the album before that, you only did a few with the Soft Boys. Underwater Moonlight resonated with me because it seemed to have a lot of venom in it. And I don't know if it was there, but Insanely Jealous, you know, I listened to that song over and over again. And there was and also the album before that, the intensity of how you were playing, there was a fucking edge to it that you seemed to mean business. Now, was that just a younger man, having that freedom to sort of push that out there and provoke?
I don't think it was just freedom. I think it's just part of the condition of being younger.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, 25, 26, 27 when I made those records. So, same age as John Lennon when he was doing your blues and, you know.
Yeah,
Or Dylan, I think, had actually already peaked. You know, he'd fallen off the bike at 25. But essentially, you're talking about a young guy in his 20s. And at that point, you're still, all your frustration, your venom, your testosterone,
yeah,
all that, you know, you're aggressive. You're still only, you know, the best time to recruit boys as soldiers is when they're 13, 14. You know, they've reached puberty, but they're not having sex yet. And so they think they're indestructible and they'll go and kill anything.
Yeah.
You know, I was full of piss and vinegar at that stage.
And when did you start, like, because obviously, like, it seems like now you're more closer to the folk music that resonated with you at 17. But it seemed like at some point something else filled your head. You know, you put a band together. You chose a style of music that was not necessarily hugely. It was definitely not the Beatles. It was more like, you know, some other. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people talk about Syd Barrett when they talk about you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people talk about that type of psychedelic sound. But you're also, in those early records, it was definitely, there was more poppiness to it. How much, who influenced you later? I mean, maybe Dylan put the drive shaft in, but when did you start to realize that, you know, you're going to rock?
Well, I think Dylan, putting it really crudely, Dylan and Doctor Who and Bertie Wooster showed me what I could be.
Right.
I think Syd Barrett showed me how I could be it. You know, I wasn't a curly-haired Jewish kid from Minnesota. I was a mother's boy from the home counties of southern England.
Yeah.
In the course of all that, though, I started getting to know other musicians, and also I was listening, you know, gradually absorbing stuff, but it sort of kept coming back to the Beatles. I mean, I remember somebody playing the first Soft Boys EP, which is what I would now call art rock. You know, you can see little bits of Captain Beefheart and little bits of Syd Barrett in it, and plus the stuff the other guys were listening to, you know, the Beach Boys and Steely Dan. But what we all had in common was the Beatles.
Right.
I remember somebody saying, oh, I think it sounds like the Beatles, really. And you know, nobody else did. But I think the common thread, certainly every time I've recorded with that template, whether it was with the Soft Boys or with Egyptians or with the Venus 3, you know, the later one with the REM guys, Peter Buck and Scott McCoy. And it's always a version of Beatle music. Whenever I have two guitars, bass, drums, and harmonies, what I invariably do is Beatle music. And it doesn't really matter who I'm working with. I don't mean they're insignificant, but I always find people that want to make Beatle music. Statistically, about 75% of them are also into Steely Dan, which I'm not.
Not either.
But we can then both unlisten to the same records.
Well, what is it about Steely Dan that everybody likes so fucking much? I mean, I get it. You know, it's sweet music in a way, but it doesn't ever feel. It always feels like it almost satisfying. It's never satisfying. Okay, I get the production's great now.
I think it depends what flavor you like.
Yeah.
I mean, do you like Tom Waits?
Sure.
Because I don't. I just don't. I'm not drawn to Tom Waits. I don't think he's bad or anything. I just, there's something about the sound of his voice that doesn't do it for me. Like,
right.
Like this, the sound of Bob Dylan's voice will turn people off. You know,
yeah.
And I think it's just a flavor thing. Some people get a certain.
Right.
And so I think some people, whatever it, you know, it could be like what blood group you are. So you put on Steely Dan and it's Donald Fagen singing or something. And just the tone of that voice. It's like for your cats, if you scratch their back or give them catnip, they go,
yeah, right.
You know, whereas if the Dan doesn't resonate with you, or doesn't go into your bloodstream, right, you just go, ooh, you know. To me, Steely Dan seems, my problem with him is it's airtight. It's
sterile.
Completely, well, it's crafted. It's like the nightclub in the days before the smoking ban where you couldn't open the window and so it would just fill up with, you know, it just makes you want to go and clear your nostrils, take a walk on the Welsh hills, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listen to an underproduced Nick Drake record or something.
Right, right.
You know?
What was the first Syd Barrett thing that you came in contact with?
It was the Arnold Lane, the first 45, which was produced by Joe Boyd, who has coincidentally produced my new record.
Was the first time you worked with him?
No, I've worked with him quite a lot on a number of things. So eventually we actually did this record. But it's beautifully recorded. It's recorded by the engineers John Wood, who did Buena Vista Social Club, and he did the people, the rock people that Joe worked with in the 80s, like REM and Billy Bragg and 10,000 Maniacs. But he, since Buena Vista Social Club, Jerry has become highly rated as a world music. I love that as a recorded, you know, the idea of what's not world music?
Yeah.
Where does not world music come from, you know?
World music always seems to involve African rhythms in my mind.
Well, I think that's the idea. It's like, okay, well, if it's not from, if it's not done by middle class white people from Britain and America, it must be world music. It's done by the Africans.
Right.
But my record's very simple and very, you know, it is the product of a 60-year-old man. I don't know what the 23-year-old me would have thought of it. They'd have been, the 15-year-old me would have been thrilled that I was finally, you know, had a record with produced by Joe Boyd on it. But they'd probably find it disgustingly mellow, you know, there's nothing.
But it's like, but that's the evolution of the artist, right? I mean, what are you going to do? I think that, like, going back to your feelings about, you know, reuniting the Soft Boys and that weirdness, is that you can't really go back.
No, you can't. And that's, again, I mean, actually, one of the great things about Nick Lowe is that he's embraced his age. He makes records that sound like the guy he is. He's not trying to squeeze himself into a younger person's clothes or hair or anything. And the same with Dylan. Dylan almost relishes the ravages that time have made on him.
Yeah.
Whereas there's people like McCartney who fight it, you know, who still want to look and sound like Beatle Paul. Well, you know, I suppose if you're selling out 50,000 seat stadiums to people who want to hear, work it out, you know, look, there's one of them, here I am, you know.
Well, they're the Beatles, there's only two left.
Exactly, you know, so Paul wants to keep the brand going, and that involves looking that way. But it's on the whole better if you can go with time, but I don't know, you know, you don't have to accelerate it. I'm lucky. My voice has held up.
Yeah.
And I've learned quite a lot, but I'm still, I don't know, my stuff doesn't sound that old.
I don't think so.
So I don't know, really. But we were somewhere. We must have been.
Sid Barrett, the first 45.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I heard that. And then Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And
it was out there, man. When you say that the first Soft Boys EPs were art rock now, I mean, did Sid Barrett represent some sort of idea that, like, holy shit, you can really push it?
No, I don't think I thought of pushing anything. Having gone from, you know, if I was Doctor Who, Bertie Wooster and Bob Dylan, really, you know, there was sort of, I suppose there was a degree of science fiction and a sense of possibility. It was all about anything might happen, I suppose. That was the best thing I liked about those characters and the kind of music they produced, and one of the best things about the 60s and the psychedelic era and the whole social revolution, if you like. You know, I remember the world going into color on January the 1st, 1965, and because I was a bit too young to get fucked up on drugs at the time, I was really aware of everything moving.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the end of 1968, modern life as we know it was kind of there, you know. And if you go back to 1963, it was the old days.
Yeah.
It was essentially, although rock and roll had happened, it was still like 1945. People were still dressed in that way. Men wore caps and women wore headscarves. And by the end of the 60s, they were kind of beginning to look like they do now. You know, whatever it was, and it's quite hard to define what it was, happened in that period. And the music went with it. But I started making music 10 years, or releasing records 10 years later, when the the momentum from the 60s had stopped and begun to swing back. You were getting Reagan getting into place. You were getting Thatcher leading the Conservatives. It was the sense of progress and momentum had stopped. You know, the pendulum had swung that far and it was beginning to go back. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we did Underwater Moonlight, you know, the Russians had invaded Afghanistan. There'd been the Iran hostage situation here. You know, I remember meeting a bunch of U.S. servicemen who turned up at one of our gigs in Scotland and said, yeah, Qatar's a pussy, man. We should nuke Iran, you know. Yeah. And we were thinking, what the fuck, you know. Yeah. It was real. So if you think I was sounding venomous and things, it was a lot of paranoia around. You could really see that everything you'd hoped for in the 60s was not happening.
Right.
I mean, you know, there had been a lot of progress, but the mood had just changed. And then the Capitol off John Lennon was shot, you know. The worst. So we were really tipped into the beginning of the 80s with a sort of complete sense of despair. And
did that affect you, like, deeply?
Well, I've always been fairly morose, but I just listened to a lot of Brian Ferry and I just drank heavily. And I dare say the edge went off my music and I just started to become a bit dreamier, you know. I started...
Detached?
Well, I think I was always detached, but I think I became even more so. And but, you know, what I liked about Syd Barrett wasn't so much the sense of experiment. There was just... Again, there's something in somebody's voice.
Yeah.
Something in Bob Dylan's voice.
Right.
Up till the bike crash, and then it gradually... evaporated, and there's things still in it. There's soul and depth and timing and humor, but there's some essence left him. He didn't die, but a little bit of him went, you know. Barrett had something for two or three intense years, and then it all went so completely he wasn't even Sid anymore. He was Roger. He was a bald guy who wandered around and painted and was stalked by his fans, and he'd effectively got rid of himself.
Did you know? Try to find him?
No, I didn't try to find him, but I knew what was going on, you know.
What was it exactly?
I don't know what happened to him, which again increased the enigma, you know. And ironically, the same with Dylan. You know, Dylan attracted all this attention and then tried to shrug his shoulders and go, oh, me, man, I don't know nothing. You know. Barrett had this phenomenal talent. He was a beautiful looking guy. There was something in his voice, something in the songs he sang that was, again, you know, it's the honesty of the unconscious.
Yeah.
I've said this before, but I think both of them had it. I think Captain Beefheart had it for a while. It's something that I've tried to allow. You don't pursue it. You have to allow it to happen.
Something has to get out and you let it.
Well, but you have to also encourage it to, before it can get out of you, you have to let it ferment inside you. You have to be open to these things.
Right.
It's like being prepared to sing your dreams. You know, I don't know if my dreams are any more exotic than my accountant's dreams, but I do know is that, you know, he'd just go, oh, I have a funny dream or something, but it's not important to him, whereas to me, that's how my mind works.
Do you actually use your dream?
No, I don't, but I think it's the same mechanism.
That's what's speaking.
And again, you know, we don't know what it is.
Right.
It's just there's something goes on inside us, some fermentation, some chemical reaction of the different, of us reacting to the way our lives are settling in on us every day, like a telephone wire, telegraph wire vibrating when the birds land on it or something. You know, we're just reacting to our lives, and that becomes our dreams, but it also becomes the creations. I just think it's probably all the same part of you, and that's extremely important to me. And so, and probably because I come from an art background, you know, my dad was an artist and my mother encouraged the arts, you know, so I was brought up to think this sort of thing was important, and I could see it in those guys particularly. And at that stage they tended to be men. I mean, Joni Mitchell was probably the first female to really unleash herself that way. But
did she blow your mind?
No, but she's very good. But yeah. You know, but I this is really me at a kind of certain stage when those things hit me.
What about Bowie?
Bowie is really good, but he's later on. Bowie is a 70s. He had the momentum in the 70s that Dylan had in the 60s.
Right.
And listening to Heroes, you know, I think it's a work of genius up there with Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It's pushing things.
Yeah.
The mixture of pop music and avant-garde. And it's also very visual. There's an awful lot to crops up in your mind or my mind. It's a great record to paint or draw to.
Yeah, yeah.
I see a lot when I listen to Heroes. It's just, you know, it all, like Barrett stuff I love painting or drawing to. You know, he was a visual artist and I see a lot. And Beefheart, another artist, and I know Bowie paints. And, you know, there's some, like I said, it's really, it's very linked up to the visual and the what you hear.
Yeah. And what's your favorite Beefheart album?
The most listenable one is Clear Spot, which is the one that should have been a big hit.
I got all of them. I tried to, like, I really tried to fill my head with them.
Your favorite one?
I like the weird old noisy ones. I mean, I like Trout Mask Replica, and I like Safe as Milk, and I like, I just recently got into them, so I haven't plowed it into my head thoroughly.
It's pretty dense stuff.
Well, it is, because a lot of it, it's sort of, it sneaks up on you, because some of it is pretty garagey and pretty bluesy, and then all of a sudden everything breaks apart, and you're like, where are we now?
Well, he definitely had those three phases. He had the sort of bluesy garage, the Ry Cooda.
Yeah.
Are very testosterone. Pushing, you know, a little bit druggy probably, but essentially, you know, white guys doing black music.
Like, right.
But really forceful. And then a few years later, you got Trout Mask Replica, which is everything kind of refracted through an unlikely prism and put together pretty much using the magic band as slave labor. But the result is that they produced a piece of music that no one had done before or since. You can't rip that stuff off. and no one would want to put themselves in the situation to make it. And even if they did, they wouldn't come up with that.
Right, you couldn't do a cover of that record.
Well, you could do a cover, but you couldn't, if you or I took, you know, five young recruits and went and starved them and lived in a house in Encino, you know,
right.
the cops would come round. Now the guys would be tweeting and saying, get me out of here, you know, but it can't be repeated, you know. And then you got the sort of funk phase, Clear Spot, a few years later, which was delicious and enjoyable and would have been a big hit, but Beefheart being Beefheart couldn't stabilize enough to sell it. And I think also he already had a reputation as being something that wasn't something everybody could listen. This is not for everybody.
He's like,
dear,
some sort of desert wizard.
You have to be a certain kind of person to get Beefheart.
Same with Zappa.
Don't worry about that. Zappa managed to be more mass market, but again, I never developed a taste for him, and I love Beefheart, but you know, he had those three phases, and he was.
It seems like you do too, don't you? I mean, as a solo artist, I mean, you put out a record almost every year.
Yeah, my records tend to be, I always think of them as reactions to each other, like a windscreen wiper going from one side to the other. So
you try to cancel yourself out,
pretty much. Well, no, I try to achieve balance. So I probably make a record with a band, you know, and basically yet another one of my Beatles records, and then I go, okay, I'll make a quiet one. So I've just done I did a produced sounding one last year, Love from London, although it wasn't with a band, but it sounds like it. It's for me, it's the very produced, arranged end of my spectrum, oddly enough done in a smoky bedroom in Clerkenwell by my friend Paul Noble. And then the complete opposite is the one I've just done with Joe Boyd, which is, very organic and simple and no overdubs and no edits and all that kind of stuff. So I imagine, you know, I don't know if I'll then do another. My next one will be very produced sound. I mean, I just go back and forth.
Well, when Globe of Frogs came out, for some reason in my mind, that felt like this was a big record in my mind. Was it a big record for you?
Big in what way?
Well, did it sell better than the other ones? There was sort of some radio play involved in that one.
It sold more relatively, but you know, that probably just meant it sold another 30,000-40,000 copies than I normally did, and then after a while that just evaporated, you know, and I sell whatever I used to sell, except that now people don't buy records, I sell less of it, so it can't.
Well, you give away songs now. I mean, I went to your website to catch up.
And they're taken, you know.
You can download for free the 45s that you're putting.
The Phantom 45s.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. There's an honesty box. You can pay for them if you want, or you can download them. I don't know. I mean, I have those, but I also have other records. I'm quite prolific, so I'm quite happy to give a bit of away.
Well, it seems like that's the thing. You just keep working and you record as much as possible.
Well, I do, because one day I won't be here to record it, and unless I can get or somebody can get a computer with a Robin Hitchcock app which produces, you know, what I might have been doing, and I think that's quite possible that they will come up with it, and I wouldn't feel sad if they did, because, you know, I'd love to feel I was still there in some way, but until that, you know, once I'm gone, I'm going to leave a finite body of work.
But it's a big one.
Well, you know, it's so be it. If, you know, if anyone wants to listen, I really would like to keep producing stuff up till and maybe beyond my exit from this world. I just, you know, that's what I'm for. I produce these things, and I also now record quite a lot of other people's songs. I'm late in my career, sort of becoming more of an interpreter. Half the records on the songs on my new record are covers.
And of
who have I got? Brian Ferry.
Which song?
It's called "To Turn You On." You know, the last Roxy album.
Yeah,
That song of the Psychedelic Furs, "The Ghost in You." What's the other one? A Grant Lee Phillips song. "Don't Look Down" off his first solo record.
He's a good guy.
He's a brilliant guy and a beautiful singer.
Yeah.
Grant, I've got that. I've got a Doors song, "The Crystal Ship."
Oh, really?
And And I've got Annalise Frøkdahl, the Norwegian chanteuse who sings with me on the record. There's a song that she co-wrote called "Ferries," which I'm also singing. So there's five covers and five originals, and I'm now just, you know.
How do you pick those, man? How do you pick the Crystal Ship?
Oh, because I've been singing it for years, and I love it. I mean, I pick songs because I like them.
Yeah.
But I'm already thinking again if you know, I like that format of doing, mixing up my songs with other people's and seeing if I can make them work together so it doesn't. There's not a big chasm between mine and others. And I can, you know, they're all my performances, really. I mean, it's this whole thing of originality. The people we've been talking about, Dylan and Barrett and Beefheart, my prime influences, they were all people who did something that had never happened before, which was one of the hallmarks of the 60s. It's much harder to produce a piece of music now that just couldn't have happened in the past. I mean, harder certainly for someone of my age, and, you know, newer minds will blend influences in a way that I can't, because I just don't come from that world. I couldn't make a Boards of Canada record or something, you know. I mean, I could possibly make a record that sounded like Cass McCombs or something, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I'm not equipped, and it would sound tragic, you know, as me as an old chap puffing up the hill trying to catch up with what's already long gone, you know, chasing the train as it leaves the station.
Yeah, you might as well just hold true to who you are.
Well, but you know, but it is interesting that moment when people pick stuff, they're going for things that haven't happened before, and that's what those guys did. They were original in a way, but you know what it's also how you mix things up. You know, Bob Dylan was basically kind of mixing up T.S. Eliot with Bo Diddley.
Sure.
But also, you know, T.S. Eliot himself was a magpie, a jackdaw. He was somebody who threw lots of old quotes in and then crafted new stuff around it. And,
everything appropriate. You know, everything.
Yeah, appropriate. All I mean is I think that in a way, I don't know whether it's quite, I don't know how much one can originate anything. Maybe it's just a matter of how you blend existing things together.
Well, I think what we talked about before, that the weird thing about being original, that moment of unconscious, that first moment.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one. So, well, you know, that's the original.
Well, there's the point when the original thought occurs. Yeah, yeah. Maybe it's just the style.
Well, there's style you have to hold on to after a certain point because you do have a certain, you have people that like you, you have a fan base, and you have a point of view, and you have a sound. And, you know, it would be a bold move, as you said, to huff up the hill and change it all around. I mean, if this is, you know, this is the world you've created, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't. I mean, I think you need to just sort of let a bit of fresh water in sometimes. Otherwise, you can see what happens when people just churn around, going around the same old stuff. They refine it, but they become sterile, you know, because they're basically working on things they've been working on forever. And you just need to let some
And you keep some writing. Air and water into it. The writing is essential to that. I mean, you know, if the lyrics at the core of it, which is, you know, your lyrics are great and always evolving and always interesting. So, I mean, you know, if you keep writing those things down, you know, you keep moving, you keep growing.
Well, I keep writing because I keep living.
It's a reaction. As a morbid person, as a poet and a former somewhat, I don't know if anger is the right word, but I mean, what part is, as you get older, does mortality play in your thinking? Other than I got to leave some stuff.
I think it's the part, it's always played, actually. I got to leave some stuff. I know I'm not going to be here very long. And I suppose there's a bit less time to drum your fingers, a bit less time to, you know, we just need to idle. We're restless, but we're also designed to be unconscious and inert for about 30% of our lives.
Yeah.
Think how long we have to spend just, you know, you go crazy if you don't sleep.
Yeah.
So we need to have breaks. We need to have points where we're, you know, just watching Mad Men or whatever it is,
sure,
or sport, or just, you know, lining up paper clips. Those things that appear to not be getting you anywhere are in some way doing that. And you think, God, I'd just like to cut through all this dead time. If I didn't sleep, I could write another 400 songs, you know. But unfortunately, it's not like that. We don't know who we are yet, and we don't know what we're doing. You know, we have not yet got into the bank vault that has our instructions that explain why we're here. We're still wandering around with just, you know, we've got a couple of old crumpled up post-it notes in the pocket saying, I think they said to what are you, you know, we just do not know. We're still trying to figure it out.
Well, it's sort of funny how Dylan in these last records, you know, certainly when Time Out of Mind came out, you definitely got the feeling just from, I think, Lenoir produced that. I think that that you got the idea of a guy, you know, sort of, you know, the something was dimming, something got simple, something became more stripped down with him in later in life. Do you find that happening to you? Are your lyrics changing? Are they becoming, you know, more reflective and simpler?
I wish. I think things are actually, the longer I live, the more complicated things seem. I am maybe writing stuff that is, or I'm trying to, but I don't know how much control I have over this. So
yeah.
I've got some new songs people say are pretty direct, but my stuff goes in spirals, you know. I mean, not only am I doing the windscreen wiper in terms of style, in terms of this is a full record and this is an empty record, but the other one is being a kind of they go from being kind of rather daft and inane to being rather morose, and then they get sort of poignant, and then they cross the date line and they become silly. And I just know that it's not a mood swing, but it's a mood cycle.
Yeah.
So my songs just, spiral around from sort of being a bit jolly and inane and to being just rather bleak or morose or whatever, you know. That's the way it is.
I think that's more honest than trying to get it all in one song. You might as well just be straightforward with the feelings of life in general, you know, that like some days are better than others and then things get dark.
Yeah.
And then things get, oh, well, that's sweet. I'm going to have a tear here. And then back to the beginning.
But you never, you don't know what you're going to do, do you? So it's like, you know, if someone came up to you and said, what are you going to say at 3:45 tomorrow afternoon? You say, well, am I giving a speech? And you, I just wonder what you might say. Well, that depends what's been happening. So,
yeah.
You must have this as well as an artist, as a creative individual, that you live in hope that you're going to produce something, that you're going to get something great. You're going to catch the big fish.
Sometimes it's just for me, like if I perform, if I do stand up, I know the thing that's never going to happen again is the thing I'm looking for. That, you know, that moment that you were talking about before where something just comes together on stage. It's different with music because I think you have a better shot at recreating a moment, especially if it's attached to music. But if something happens improvisationally on a stage that never happened before and that probably I could not recreate, sadly, those are the moments that I live for.
Well, that's... but that's good to know. I mean, I don't think you can recreate it. You can record it.
Yeah.
So if you happen to be someone's recording your act, you know,
right.
Then they'll say, okay, this is the moment he came up with, you know, they listen to this.
Right.
But arguably you can't recreate it, but it's still worth doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what it feels the most alive.
Yeah, because it's something you had not anticipated.
Exactly.
But what you can do is you can create the conditions in which it's most likely to happen.
That's right.
You know, it's like trying to create a situation in which lightning will strike.
Yeah. And then you just hope for it.
You hope for it. You know, or yeah. you can cover yourself in gasoline and run naked out into the lightning and say, take me, take
me. Let's
do
it. You
know.
You want to play a song?
I can certainly try. Hang on.
Are you in town for a while?
No, I have to go tomorrow.
Where to?
I'm going up to Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know Eugene Merman?
Yeah.
Eugene's just done recording live comedy. He's just done three nights at this place I'm going to play, the Columbia Theatre.
Oh, really?
I've never been there before.
I play the Neptune up there.
Oh, I know the Neptune. Yeah, I played that last year, yeah.
That's a good venue.
Yeah.
Yeah, Huge and I know Huge. He's been on the show a few times.
Oh, has
we
he?
Have the, we have the same manager.
Do you?
Olivia Wingate. She's British.
Oh, I think I might have met her.
Probably.
Eugene and I have had some mammoth grooves.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Do you smoke?
Well, I only smoke when I drink, but I think I stopped everything for... I remember I hadn't had a cigarette or a drink since Christmas, and then I ran across Eugene in February. Well, I knew it was coming, but, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to have 6 weeks off because I'm going to see Eugene in early February. Blow it all out. Yeah, no, we had some major grooves. You got a heart full of soul and a mind beyond control, and the way you look down
the dark look in your eyes. You don't ever that you feel is turning your soul into steel. You got trouble in your blood and a word in your rose bud. You don't know what you do to me no more. You got a well constructed shell deep inside, you're deep in hell, and you can't be satisfied. Knows how much you just try. You got trouble in your blood and your road is full of. Can't be satisfied. You don't know what you do to me no more. Blood goes on. Trouble in your blood goes on.
So that's Trouble in Your Blood, which is on the new one.
Great.
Thank you.
That sounded great. Thanks so much for playing it.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot, man. Thanks for talking to me.
It's a pleasure.
All right, that's it. That sounded great. He's great. He's a singular talent, that guy, and I'm glad Robin Hitchcock stopped by. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs for, you know, you can... You can look at the episode guide, and for God's sakes, get the app. If you're new to the thing, get the free app and upgrade to premium, and you can stream like 500, so on, however many episodes. As you know, the most recent 50, always free. So everything's free for 6 months. But yeah, there's merch there. There's, you know, posters. There's stuff. You can comment now if you have a Facebook account and you identify yourself, at least whatever your Facebook identity is. I like it better like that, and it seems to be working out in terms of comments. I engage more with the comment section now that I can see people's faces, and I can, if someone's a douchebag, I can go, Bill, you're being kind of a douchebag. So that's there. Schedule's there. Everything's there. JustCoffee.coop is also available at WTFpod.com. If you get the WTF blend, you know, I get a little bit on the back end. They keep sending me coffee. I have a lot of coffee. I'm gifting coffee. That's what's happening. Boomer lives!